Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Welcome, dear listeners, to the Mad Scientist Podcast. What are we talking about today, Marie?
That was my Mitch McConnell impersonation.
Hey!
Oh, good night, everybody. You've been great. Today, we wrap up talking about King Tutankhamun and talking about a very Halloween-esque subject, about time we rolled around to it, the mummy's curse.
The mummy's curse! Bum, 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 bum.
That was me playing the organ,
yep.
Not being Mitch McConnell.
Yep. And now Jake rolls the tape. All right.
This is my favorite part. Like, this is where I feel like Howard Carter, like all of the sort of the factual learning about archaeology, that's great. Like Egyptology, that's really good. I love that stuff, right? That's interesting and it's real. Here's where I think we really, this is where we start to hit our wheelhouse, right? And saying, okay, so now how did all of those events get warped into something spooky?
No, yeah, archaeology is all that studying archaeology and all that other crap. That's all fine. We're finally at ghosts. Okay. So last episode, we talked a little bit about how they finally found the tomb, mm-hmm. how excited they all were, and also some of the ideas about like conserving the items themselves and how they had to get over to it. What's interesting, though, so as soon as the tomb was found and pictures of the tombs themselves and the objects there started getting out there, the world went crazy with Egyptomania, is what they called it. It's this.
Yeah.
And so we have an interesting quote here. So this is from Paul Collins, the curator for the ancient Near East at the Ashmolean Museum in Oxford. It says, quote, "Egyptomania was fed by a perfect storm of technology. The moment when radio, telegram, mass circulation newspapers, and moving film came together so everyone could have a bit of Tut," end quote. It's really interesting. There are, if you look back at like the fashion of the 1920s, you'll see things like snakes and lotus flowers and all this other stuff. And especially the work of especially the work of Burton, the photographer, became really important. So we talked a little bit about him at the end of last episode, but this is Harry Burton. He shows up to take these photos, and his photos start becoming – like they get out there in the United States, and people just – they love them. Right. They love them. They thought they were fascinating. And so all of that.
How foreign. How exotic.
Right. So all of that starts to get in there. Now, interestingly, though, so another aspect of kind of King Tut's mystique and mystery here is the fact that he's a boy king.
Yes.
And not only is he a boy king, but he's a boy king with a bunch of injuries, you know, so that, you know, his ankle was or his leg was all messed up and you know, his head was like caved in, like all this other stuff, whatever.
There was clearly his cause of death was not old age. He didn't die peaceful in his sleep.
No, absolutely not. Right? And so what's interesting is this kind of Egyptomania or this love of King Tut. It spoke to people at the time, I think, in a little bit of a deeper way, Marie, as you said here, because he was not old. He was a young man who was injured, leading his country, whatever. This is a time period here we're talking about where people are coming back from World War One.
Yep.
World War One was not good on the body.
No.
So people come back. They are damaged. They are injured. They are
bandaged.
They are in pain. And so mm-hmm. This idea of a mummy, of a thing, mm-hmm. of an injured dead who would come back for revenge on the country or on the people who disturbed them or who took over mm-hmm. their country. Mm-hmm. It's a very compelling story.
Well, it's perfect. Like he's right in saying it is the perfect storm, right? Because you've got the roaring 20s. So there's this consumerism, right? There's this hunger for stuff. Like we love gold, right? The idea of the shiny gold, the conspicuous consumerism became a term that was actually coined during that time phrase. And like the idea of like mass consumers, production, getting sort of the artifacts, right? So you could have your own little Egyptian cat, or you could have your own gold necklace, or all of this stuff started to hit the market. And it became sort of, again, like this hunger for things mm-hmm. and coinciding with the idea of the boy king and post-war England, post-war Europe was this idea of that there doesn't have to be shame in being injured, right? That it's not exactly a glorification of it, but it's a normalization of it. And even a mass media sort of representation of something that is in some ways glorified, right? Like King Tut and the mummy of King Tut and the power of that sort of helped heal some of the psychological wounds, or at least kind of gave a different outlet to grieving the injured or the shame of coming home hurt. Which isn't the truth in any way, but is like a perceived national sort of psychic ennui. You know what I mean? Like if you lose and your young men are coming home bandaged and vets now that are they have to take care of, this is sort of almost this kind of weird sci-fi reaction to it in this glorification of this young man. But to your point too, the idea of it, that he has a right to a vengeance, that there's an anger behind it, I think is especially fascinating, because that's like, it's not like everything is okay, but it's like now he has a right to to take revenge on those who did this wrong to him.
Absolutely. And what's interesting actually is that all of this kind of media craze will culminate mm-hmm. in 1932 with the release of The Mummy, the horror film by Universal. And interestingly, actually, Marie, you dug this up. The first journalist to see the face of the Pharaoh was supposedly John Balderston, who would write the script for The Mummy.
Which is, I love that. Like that to me, full circle.
Super interesting.
Here's a guy who witnesses a historic event, and then who's like, you know what? I see a script. I feel a script. Yeah. 25 words or less.
Freaking crazy.
The curse comes back.
You know? Crazy. Anyways, so, okay. So the other part of this, the other part of the kind of mummy craze that happens at this time is the curse. Now, everyone who's listening to this has probably heard of the mummy's curse or the curse. You know, the idea is that you enter this tomb that's been sealed and you open it up and
by exotic people long ago.
Right. And then
see the light of day again.
Yeah. And then their evil spirit or whatever, the god that's protecting them or, you know, all this other junk, whatever, comes back and then kills you. You know, so, or it hurts you or whatever. So
it's not just, but it's like the created pastiche of that culture comes back to kill you. It's the plague of the Beatles, or it's like, you know, it's not just like, oh, you know, and then you fall off a bridge or you're trampled by horses. There's something sort of, there's going to be something notable about your death that can be directly correlated to that curse.
Yeah.
Right. So it's this whole it's sort of like this exotic, heightened, again, sort of colonial, right? Like sort of you know, taking advantage of a culture that you've just yanked or tried to take everything out of their country.
Yeah. So what's interesting is this all starts actually with a novelist, Marie Corelli, saying the most dire punishments follow any rash intruder into a sealed tomb. And this comes out a couple of weeks before the death of Lord Carnarvon, finally.
Yes.
So this guy has been ill like the entire time we've been talking about him, right?
Yeah.
He has not been doing
chain
great.
Chain smoking, right? Chain yeah. smoking the right. entire
chain,
time as well.
Chain smoking, like just killing it. And a couple months after the tomb is open, he dies. So essentially, he just kind of comes down with an illness, is transferred to Cairo, and then he'll die. They're not sure what caused his death, but supposedly it comes from an infection due to an insect bite.
Supposedly.
Yes. Now, the legend says that when he died, there was a power failure in Cairo, and his son back in England will report that his favorite dog howled and then suddenly dropped dead. Now, one wonders, considering how much time he spends in Egypt, how favorite could this dog have possibly been? You know, that's question
his
one.
Favorite hound.
Yeah, like it's.
I dare you,
that
sir.
That seems crazy. But anyways.
I dare you, sir, question the legitimacy and timing, not to mention like. What time of day was it? Like, was it at night? Because, I mean, it's like, what is the time difference?
Okay. No, the exact time. Now, the other thing, too,
how
that's
dare
interesting.
You, sir. Sorry.
The other part of this myth that'll get built in is this idea that when Tut is finally unwrapped, then in 1925, it has a wound on the cheek in the same place that Carnarvon had this insect bite.
Bum, bum, bum.
Right. So this is this idea here that this mummy opening it up will kill you. And so this myth gets even built further and further because so 1929 now, 11 people connected to the discovery of the tomb will have died from unnatural, quote unquote, unnatural causes.
Early and unnatural.
And early, yes. Right? So two of Carnarvon's relatives, his secretary, Richard Bethel, and Bethel's father, Lord Westerbury. Westerbury will kill himself by jumping from a building, and he left a note that is pretty kind of scary. He said, quote, "I really cannot stand any more horrors and hardly see what good I am going to do here, so I am making my exit," end quote.
Pretty definitive, too.
Pretty definitive.
I'd say so.
Now, every time another death happened that was like related to Carnarvon, right? So, you know, Carnarvon's maid's cat dies. his, you know, another guy named Carnarvon dies. So not Carnarvon, but Carnarvon. Maybe the curse is bad. Mm-hmm. I don't know, bad English or whatever.
Oh, I mean, it was in hieroglyphics. It could have, it was a translation error.
Every time someone new dies, the press is like, the mummy's curse strikes again. And so by 1935, they're saying King Tut has 21 victims, which puts him right up there with like, you know,
the
worst serial killers in history.
But what I love is, again, it's like if it bleeds, it leads, right? Like that even that much time afterwards, they are still attributing the curse. They're still getting it. Like, to me, that is sort of a commentary on our culture as well, and the fact that we are, like going kind of into the discussion that we were having earlier, that we have this sort of hunger for this stuff as well, right? Because they're not going to be putting it out about the mummy's curse if people were like, I don't know about that. That doesn't seem right. Or not having an interest in it.
Well,
because, you know, we love it. I mean, I'm not saying that we're exempt from it. As soon as I was like, ooh, Tut, heck yeah, we're going to talk about the curse.
Yeah, well, I think also it's like this idea that, I don't know. I wonder, do you think, Marie, they had like leftover guilt? Like, I wonder if they were like, man, this is kind of, I don't know, kind of weird. Because
that they took stuff out of the guilt that they, yeah, I think.
Well, we did a whole series on the history of surgery, where they were like, no, you can't, no, you're not supposed to go into tombs. And you know what I mean? Like, the English mm-hmm. at this time period mm-hmm. had huge, you know, we're talking like up to the 1880s. And even to the modern day, we're still really weird about dead bodies.
I think it's an interesting clash. I think on one side they're the colonialists and they are explorers, and they feel that they have a right to go in and excavate and take, right? Like if they have the knowledge and if they have the ability, they're going to persevere and they're going to find this, and they have the right to do so. But then I would venture, and this is sort of an interesting, again, this is all hypothesis, subjecture, that subliminally that does take effect, that you were going into a tomb, that you were going into not just a historical figure, but like the body of the historical figure. And I think that's got to have some effect, right? That's just got to, because you don't get to escape that, because that's really the subject of what you're doing. And I mean, you can kind of obfuscate it and try and, you know, and put a lot of different things around it, but you're still coming down to it's a grave. Mm-hmm. It's a grave, and you are taking the body, and you're going to actually also physically dismantle that body. So I think that there was some guilt that worked its way into sort of, you know, the educational, informational, you know, on top, but then down deep, I can't imagine that they wouldn't. I mean, that's a good point. So it's like, how does that manifest itself? It manifests itself in the curse that you will be, you know, but this isn't right, that there's something about it that's not right, which is kind of true. It's like, if you think about archaeology, it's like, and especially if you think about graves, like those weren't supposed to be disturbed, right? That's why they effing buried them that far down and blocked them off. It was like that was supposed to be the final resting place. You're not supposed to go back into that. And it's like, again, like I think that you should have that type of reaction to that type of excavation. My two cents. It's a little ghoulish. Yes. Check that box. It's a little ghoulish.
Now, all right. So eventually, you know, this idea of a curse, right? So mm-hmm. one thing that's interesting with ideas like this, and especially with ideas of things like, say, even the Bermuda Triangle or whatever. And we talked about this actually really early on with the story of the missing men of Boston, right? There was this idea that there was a serial killer in Boston shoving young men into the waterways, or there was a curse or whatever.
Oh, the smiley face killer, right?
That was like one theory of it, but like it turned out it was just a bunch of... You put a bunch of college kids together near a bunch of water, get them really drunk, they'll fall in. You know what I mean? Like, not to be too glib about it, they're tragedies, but it's kind of what happens here.
Boston.
But if you look at like the statistics here, it's really interesting. There's not a lot to this idea of the curse, right? So Herbert Winlock, the director of the Metropolitan Museum of New York, at one point anyways, made a calculation about the effectiveness of the curse. And so he looked and said, okay, there were 22 people present when the tomb was opened in 1922. Only six of them will die by 1934. Of the 22 present at the opening of the sarcophagus in 24, only two of them will die by 1934. And of the 10 people that were there when the mummy was unwrapped in 25, all of them survived until at least 1934. So that seems like pretty average figures for people who
are Winlock.
Like your job is, if your job is traveling to exotic locations and looking for tombs, you're in a pretty dangerous line of work. You know, it's like, I don't know, like saying, you know, lion tamers have a curse on them because they always get eaten by lions. Like, well, no shit. That's their job. You know, like it's a hazard of the job.
It came down to the director of the Metropolitan Museum of Art to have to make this argument, which is kind of funny, because it's like you can only imagine that this guy has got more important things to deal with than trying to run statistics. But he was probably like, all right, that's it. I'm done reading. All right, you know what? I'm done. We're not marketing the curse. Everybody quit making that suggestion to me, you know, because his marketing department was probably like, oh, my God, we could totally market the curse. Herbert, think of it. And he's like, no. I'm just presupposing, but you know, like, no, we're just showing the mummy and here's like the actual figures. Because you very rarely, having worked with some art directors in and curators, they very rarely get around to statistics. I've noticed. I mean, it's like, that's not normally their go-to. Is they're like, okay, we're going to have to figure out the stats on this. Somebody get me the calculator and the Bowen figure or what that, you know, whatever the classical stats are. You know, it's like, they don't do that. They're right. Busy being curators and directors.
So
of like the biggest museum in one of the biggest museums in the world. Who is Matt? Okay, sorry. Go ahead.
No, it's all good. Marie, not a fan of curators. Anyways.
Hey, hold up. Like, look, you can badmouth the arts all you want. I'm a huge fan of curators. I used to work with curators. Like, I'm a huge fan of them. They just are not very...
They're not statistically inclined.
That's what I'm getting at.
All right, I understand. So, okay. Further,
you can send me your emails, people. That's fine.
At anticurator.net.
Hatemeacurator.com.
So, the final kind of nail in the coffin here was, in 2002, researchers at Monash University in Melbourne, Australia, Mark Nelson, did a study again where he looked at the curse of King Tut. And so what he looked at was, he looked at 44 Westerners who were in Egypt at the time the tomb was discovered. 25 of them are linked to the curse in some way, or at least they would have been linked to the curse because they were there at the breaking of the sacred seals, at the opening of the sarcophagus, the opening of the coffins, unwrapping of the mummy, all the cursey kind of stuff you'd expect, right? The other folks were in Egypt, but not exposed to the curse, quote unquote. The average age of death of the exposed group was 70 years.
It's quite a curse.
You're cursed to live to an average lifespan. The other, and the average survival rate for those not exposed, the average kind of age was to 75.
Mm-hmm.
Not exactly not really a curse.
Mm-hmm.
No, not really too much. And on top of that, too, as we start digging in more and more, we find that there are a lot of other holes in this, right? So, like, the idea that when Carnarvon dies, all lights in Cairo go out. This is Cairo in 1923. Power failures were super duper common. Like, you know, the power failures were common everywhere in 1923. It's not exactly like a crazy kind of thing necessarily, right?
Yes.
And on top of that, the final kind of nail in the coffin of the curse, Carter, the guy who found the tomb, was the first to open it, was there mm-hmm. for everything and
whatever.
The
mummy must have reached out from his Anwar one dark and stormy night and strangled him immediately after, right?
Unless the curse was to live to 64 and die of natural causes at home. No,
Carter! So he lived to a fine ripe old age for the time, and then died naturally.
I mean, considering his job was again like super dangerous and involved lots of travel, and like, you know, think about the dangers in 1923 of traveling to a place like Egypt. Regularly,
so then
right?
What killed him? So then, what killed Carnarvon? Huh? Because he died. Yeah, you can't argue that, can you?
We're going to get into that after the break!
Greetings from Evergreen Podcasts. We're rolling out a listener survey, and we want to hear from you. The information in the survey will help us gather statistics and in turn make our shows more appealing to advertisers. I know most people don't like ads, but this is one of the only ways our shows make money and help keep their lights on. We promise it will only take a few minutes, but the impact on our podcasts will be tremendous. As a token of our appreciation, we'll randomly select one lucky participant each month to win an exclusive merchandise package from Evergreen Podcasts. Head to evergreenpodcast.com/listenersurvey to help a show and possibly get some free stuff for doing so. We can't thank you enough for the support. Now back to the show.
Okay, so Lord Carnarvon, right?
Mm-hmm.
He dies. Like you said, cannot just cannot dispute the fact that he died. All right. At the time of his death, his cause of death is reported as pneumonia supervening on facial erysipelas, or in other words, it's a streptococcal infection of the skin and the underlying soft tissue.
Ooh, which does sound really like.
In other words, he got pneumonia from a skin infection. That's what they said, right? Mm-hmm. And so it eventually leads to like multi-organ failure and death, and it's not great. Here's the thing. We talked at the beginning of the series that after his car accident, where he was going like 25, you know, in a 2 mile per hour zone at the time.
Very fast. Yes. He was a daredevil.
No, he's going crazy. Uh-huh. He was prone to infections his entire life. They initially sent him to Egypt because they were like, the warm climate will make your clammy skin a little bit redder. You might be better in Egypt than you are in England, where it rains all the damn time, dude. So he was always sick. He was like, it would have been weirder if he wasn't sick ever again after he opened the tomb.
Yeah, he was pretty much a near invalid.
Yeah.
Really. I mean, when it comes down to it, yeah.
Yeah. So this is like, you know, I don't even know, man. This is like you're watching, you know, there must be a curse on TLC because all of those 7,000-pound people die from heart attacks. It's ridiculous. So anyways, he had a very weak constitution, probably not a very good immune system. And so, frankly, him essentially getting blood poisoning from an infected mosquito bite is not all that out of the question. However, recent work makes people think that maybe his death was due to exposure to toxic mold, namely Aspergillus, which are a group of fungi that produce a mycotoxin, which when allowed to germinate can kill you essentially. Right. So this is a type of toxin that really that it exists on food. Right?
Yeah, it's a fungal and toxin. Yeah, it's
exactly. And so
it's mold.
Yeah. And so what's good, it's not really good, but what's interesting is that this specifically exists on old food that exists in, say, tombs. Right. As we talked about, when they opened up the tomb, there were things for the afterlife. Right. So there were things like, you know, the pharaoh's favorite snack and animals and all kinds of stuff that would allow this mold to exist and germinate and just kind of, you know,
all kinds of organic material.
Absolutely, right? So it's like a really good way of getting there. And so one particular strain of this mold is known as Aspergillus niger or black mold, right? And so we've all heard of black mold before. It's the kind of mold that if you have it in your house, you like get your house fixed, basically.
You burn down the house,
right? So, this is from Dr. Ezzedine Taha of Cairo University, looked at the health records of museum workers that were working at the time and found that a lot of them had been exposed to this black mold. And so this causes things like fever, fatigue, rashes, and someone who's already immunocompromised can lead to other complications, of course, right? So he suggests, this Dr. Taha suggests, that this fungus might exist in the tombs and might have been picked up by archaeologists as they enter, right? Which makes perfect sense. Now, Aspergillus niger black mold is not the only kind of mold, though. So Dr. Nicola De Paolo, an Italian physician, found another possible fungus in the tombs, Aspergillus ochraicus, which is he found in different places across Egypt's archaeological sites. This one could have existed on artifacts from the tomb in particular. However, that type of fungus isn't normally Aspergillus niger with a healthy person can kill you, right? It's bad enough that it can really mess you up. This other kind isn't as bad for you. It can still get you sick, but it's not normally toxic, or it's not normally fatal, I should say.
Man, I just love the idea that there was a curse and it's the mold, right? There was a curse. There was something living in there just waiting if you opened it up that was going to actually activate. and could hurt you. I think that that's even more interesting because it's scientifically proven.
So here, okay, scientifically proven, let's take a step back.
Well, it's scientifically possible.
It's possible. Well, interestingly,
don't take the wind out of my sails. I'm sorry. I'm having fun with this.
I'm sorry.
Right, keep going. No.
There's fine. There's a really funny quote actually we found from F. DeWolf Miller, a professor of epidemiology at the University of Hawaii. They said, quote, "Given the sanitary conditions of the time in general and those within Egypt in particular, Lord Carnarvon would likely have been safer inside the tomb than outside the tomb." So,
casting a little shade.
God, not big up in Egypt.
Not big up in Egypt. That's pretty good.
What's funny, what's interesting about this actually is I think it's really like if you think about even today with COVID, think about how hard it is to do contact tracing on a single person.
Yeah.
In modern times. You know, they're still like trying to track people who went to Sturgis, right? Or to rallies or whatever, like or to anything, right? Like there was a wedding in Maine where they're still tracking people from that. Like it's really hard to do contact tracing. Mm-hmm. And that's with like modern day where everyone is taking photos like hashtag COVID free, hashtag at the wedding, right? Like back in the day, you know, trying to track infections due to mold spores in the 1920s or 1930s from the modern day, nearly impossible. So it's really hard to make a definitive statement. However, we do know that there's exposure to these kind of toxins can create pneumonia in immunocompromised individuals.
Yes.
And Carnarvon would have probably come in contact with some kind of molds by going into the tomb, breathing in the dank tomb air, crawling around, touching all the stuff, whatever, you know. There's even records of Carnarvon like crawling along the tomb's floor, like not good. So
and if you think about, especially now, like even thinking about PPE or whatever, it's like they didn't even really have much. I'm sure that they had some safety considerations, but it's not like they were wearing masks necessarily or wearing masks throughout.
This is right?
Or if all the workers were wearing masks or something. Because if you think about it, if you go in, the mold has settled. There's no air, right? And all of a sudden you break it open and you begin to circulate air and walk around and touch things and step on organic material. All of those spores are then active and are now like almost in a whirlpool in that small space. It's like a perfect little vector hut.
The other thing is that we're like only a couple years at this point. So we're talking like 1920. You know, this is like the germ theory of disease is still being discussed in the highest levels of academia. So they didn't know at this point that things like, you know, mold spores or like they weren't thinking about those kind of epidemiological considerations.
Yeah.
So it's possible they were taking precautions, but I don't know.
Like had an idea like he did send the canary in, right? Because they were like, okay, like that was rudimentary. Like, all right, let's see if there's
poison
or dangerous, but like not after, I would assume not after it's been opened and they're in there, you know, they have a photographer in there for Pete's sake, setting up stuff, moving stuff around.
Yeah.
You know, it's just, and it's a closed space. It makes total sense.
So, okay. Is there ultimately any reason to think that this actually happened?
So there's a curse?
No. The mold spores, right?
So,
1999, a German microbiologist, Gotthard Kramer from the University of Leipzig, looked at 40 different mummies and was able to identify several dangerous mold spores on each of them. Now, on top of that, we have those other studies that found mold spores and everything else. They can survive in, you know, very harsh conditions, even dark, dry, relatively dry tombs. And it's possible that when that when the tomb was opened, you had all of the air blowing out. It's very possible that these people got essentially a huge blast of mold spores. And then they died. Now, the problem with that is that Carnarvon would have had to have entered the tomb the day it was opened. Right. For that idea of the air blast to have hurt him to have occurred. That's not, we don't think that happened, right? Carter talks about Carnarvon. He sends Carnarvon this info after they open it. And Carnarvon's like, oh my God, I'm coming, I'm coming. And then it takes him a couple weeks, right? So it's not clear if he actually entered the tomb then or not, or how he would have gotten this exposure to mold. However, it's still a possibility, right? But at the end of the day, it has nothing to do with, he could have gotten this mold from anywhere, I guess is what I'm saying, right? He could have gotten sick from anything. He was already a sickly person.
Could have gotten an insect bite anywhere.
Exactly. What you're saying. Exactly. Like, I like the mold theory. I think it's cool, but probably not necessarily what killed Carnarvon.
Come on, man.
I'm just saying.
How about Marie? The curse? Are we honestly going to be saying that the curse was not real? Because then that's just really like, that doesn't leave me with the spooky feeling for Halloween.
I don't,
you and your scientific rationalization.
I don't know. Well, you know, the thing about these curses, or the thing about these stories always, is it reminds me of, I really like old horror movies, like really cheesy horror movies.
Love them.
And there's one in particular that's like pretty gory, and like it's pre-code, so it's pretty not even pre-code, it's like it's post, I guess, motion picture code, but it's like not in the 1960s, 1950s, somewhere around there. Mm-hmm. But it's basically this, it's like a cobbled together from a couple of different films, I think, but it's this this evil scientist is creating zombies on an island out in, like, you know, the tropics or whatever. And
what's it called? What is this movie?
Oh, I don't even know. It's something stupid. It's like, what is it? The Island of Dr. Something Sexual Deviant. It's something crazy. It's insane, right? It's an insane movie.
The Isle of Dr. Monroe?
No, it's not the Isle of Dr. Monroe, but it's like just another thing like that. But anyways.
Okay. Some ripoff of that.
Okay. But in that movie, like, they go to a tomb and then they, it's booby-trapped. Like, it's all booby-trapped, right? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And that, to me, the idea of, like, it being booby-trapped, that presupposes this idea that, like, you're doing something wrong. You know? Like, you shouldn't be stealing these things, then. If you think someone is trying to protect them, you shouldn't be trying to get them. You know? I don't know, Marie.
And if you've seen the original Boris Karloff, The Mummy, like, I think that's pre-code horror. And it's really good. I mean, it's just very, you know, it's classic, and it's classic because it's very, Boris Karloff is a great actor in it. It's spooky. It's well shot. It's, you know, it's cheesy now, but it's like, it is sort of like, it's unsettling. And I think that's the other thing that's so interesting is it's like that, just like Frankenstein, just like Dracula, the mummy perseveres, right? I mean, it's already had two remakes, the most recent with Tom Cruise, which makes zero sense. But whatevs, that's cool. But I mean, it has this sort of lasting effect, right? It hasn't, you know, the Egyptology or the idea of the undead or the, you know, the pharaoh coming back to revenge the opening of his tomb is something that we appreciate now or that we'd love to see now. So I think that's, if nothing else, if we get nothing else from it, even if there's not a curse, you should check out especially the 1932 original horror.
Abso-friggin-lutely. All right, Marie, what's next for us? What's next? Doppelgangers?
I think we should get some, since it is closing up on our favorite holiday, we have entered the time, the nigh is close. Christopher. I think we should. I think it's time for doppelgangers, which, if I remember correctly, is especially unsettling to one Christopher Cogswell.
I hate them so much. All right, we'll be back next week, listeners.
Good night.
Thank you again, dear listeners, for listening to the Mad Scientist Podcast. I have been your host, Chris Cogswell, joined by my co-host,
Marie Mayhew.
If you'd like to contact the show, please send us an email at themadscientistpodcast@gmail.com. That's all one word. You can also follow us on Twitter at madscientistpod or at Team Giant Squid for Marie. And of course, you can see us on Facebook, on Instagram, and all over the internet as the Mad Scientist Podcast. And again, our logo is the one with the pumpkin head, so it's easy to see.
Mm-hmm.
If you've enjoyed the show tonight, please consider supporting us on Patreon, where the money that you give to us will help us to promote this show further, to make it better, and just to spend more time making it.
Because we love doing that.
We do love doing that. Our logo was designed by Carrie Shaheen. Our web design is done by Desdemona Howard. And our sound design is done by Jake Cardinal. Thanks again for listening.
Thank you. This has been a Damn It Chippy production.
In a world infatuated with comic fandom, comes a show to help us remember the talents that have inspired us.
Whoa, 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 cut.
Oh, come on. It wasn't that bad.
It's a bit dramatic. Let's just tell them about the show, guys.
We are the Canned Air Podcast.
Join us weekly for a comedic trip through pop culture.
We also welcome some cool comic creators, as well as some of the voice and screen actors that helped shape your childhood.
Find us on cannedairpodcast.com and on the Evergreen Podcast Network.